In the aftermath of my sister's death, I welcomed the isolation of the country, where no one would see the darkness that had crept into my heart. I won't be alone, I reassured William. I'll have Lisbeth and little Phil, and there's no reason to waste money paying rent in town. That much was true.
Having only the youngest two children in my care now, I could undertake their education myself and hire back Mr. and Mrs. Genty to help me keep up the place.
Because at least this house was mine, even if the man who built it was not. Who was Alexander Hamilton? A traitor or a patriot? A visionary or a fool? A gentleman or a fraud? That's what I wanted to know. And now it kept me awake all night, reading the mountain of letters, pacing in fits and starts. Like Hamilton. Though my project was at once humbler and more ambitious than a pamphlet or a treatise or a book defending a new form of government, mine was simply to learn the truth. And there was more to read now than ever, because I'd never stopped collecting my husband's writings. For the biography and for myself, I needed them. And in the 10 years since he'd died, I'd hunted down thousands of letters, pamphlets, and reports from everyone and everywhere, political essays and financial treatises, and of course, account books, in which I now found that in the year Angelica came to New York without her husband, Hamilton paid her expenses. Not just those I'd known about, for which church was to have reimbursed him, but unspecified expenses too. As if Angelica had simply presented him with receipts for her shopping trips. He'd also rented rooms for her, in addition to her house. What rooms? Where were they, and why had she needed other rooms when she had that luxurious townhouse? I couldn't fathom it. And then, in the very next entry in the ledger, I found that Hamilton had purchased himself a closed coach. Ugly images rose to my mind. I'd never been to Europe, where it was common for noblemen to keep mistresses, but I could guess how a gentleman might plan clandestine meetings. Secret rooms reached by a closed coach with curtains drawn. A beautiful woman inside, whispering in French to a man hungry for her appreciation. I remembered precisely how Hamilton was that year as Secretary of the Treasury. He'd likened himself to a veritable prime minister with all the powers and privileges. He'd believed himself in command of a whole nation, so why should he be denied the caresses of any willing woman? But that was before the yellow fever, I told myself, trying desperately to salvage anything from our life together. Alexander was changed after the fever, a different husband, a better man. And Angelica, when she moved back to America, was a changed woman. The most reliable, generous, and loyal sister that any person could have. Because they were guilty, the devil inside me whispered. And they lied to you. They lied to you all your life and all of theirs, to their very last breaths. Blinking back acid tears, I realized these poisonous doubts could put the lie to my whole life. Yes, I had evidence, but it didn't prove the case. Where but in death itself might I ever confront either my husband or my sister and have an answer? I needed to stop this mad inquiry. Like my father before me, I needed to exert the self-discipline Hamilton lacked. The ability to let a thing alone when pursuing it could end in despair. But in the end, and perhaps inevitably, I'd become more like Hamilton than Papa. For I carried Angelica's box of letters, and my inquiry, up to the attic, where, assailed by a cloud of dust motes that floated in the light of my lamp, I made of the private space a makeshift office for my investigation. There, amidst crates of papers in the stifling heat, I sat hour after hour, hunched over yellowed pages, sneering at Angelica's coquettish missives, taking satisfaction that at least Hamilton hadn't bundled her letters in a sentimental ribbon. Perhaps he hadn't loved her, But had he loved me? Had either of them ever loved me? Or had Alexander and Angelica clung to each other in the fevered sweat of lovemaking, laughing at me all the while? When there was nothing left to read, I spied the engraved wooden strongbox with leather buckles where Alexander kept his old military uniforms and ornamental swords. His glory, I thought with a contemptuous snort. And all at once, I wondered if that was where I'd find the definitive evidence I was seeking. Perhaps my husband kept some treasured token of his love affair with Angelica, just as she'd kept that garter. Perhaps I'd find a matching ring with a clipping of her hair, and then all my doubts would vanish. Knowing he was to duel, Alexander would have hidden anything incriminating, or entrusted it to someone to destroy if he died. Hamilton was too smart for me. Too smart for everyone except Burr. Nevertheless, I unfastened the latch and was struck by the arresting sight of the blue and buff military coat Alexander wore the first day I met him. The wool, rougher than I remembered when I first touched him, when we first kissed. And the pain, oh, the pain of remembering that now with jaded eyes sliced into me like the bayonet beside the uniform. Like a wounded soldier, bleeding my heart out, I searched every item in the trunk until it was empty, running my hands over the velvet lining, to find the false bottom I somehow expected. And that's where I found it. A bundle of letters, and a dark braid of hair. My hands shook as I unfolded the pages. Finding neither the scent of my sister's perfume, nor the feminine scrawl of her hand, but instead the shock of a firm masculine signature. John Lawrence, a man I'd never met, whose death dealt to Alexander his worst wound of the war. Here were the letters between them. Not only the ones Lawrence wrote, but also copies of what my husband wrote to Lawrence as well. That both sides of the correspondence were so carefully preserved spoke volumes of its importance to my husband. And now I read them with near incredulity. Cold in my professions, warm in my friendships, I wish, my dear Lawrence, it might be in my power by action rather than words to convince you that I love you. It was in those days the style for men to speak of love to one another. But it was not a style Alexander embraced in his letters, not to any man I knew, save perhaps Lafayette. And yet, these were different, ardent, complete with a lewd suggestion that John Lawrence had intimate knowledge of Alexander's body. Letters that indicated a liaison between Washington's young officers for which they might both have been shot. And, quite beyond the capacity to be scandalized by anything now, I nearly laughed at my mind's sudden opening to things that ought to have been perfectly obvious before. My husband had loved this man. Clutching a lock of dark hair that was not, after all, my sister's, I remembered Alexander's unnatural grief for Lawrence. My husband's attachment to the Baron, whose handsome young male companions Theodosia Burr had once identified as sodomites. Perhaps my husband had been one of them, adopting the vice because it was forbidden. Forbidden like another man's wife. Forbidden like his wife's sister. If Hamilton could commit those sins, why not this one? Why not sate his lust with another soldier while the winter was cold and the war was harsh? Then, in a letter Alexander had written only months before we met, I found this. Such a wife as I want must be young, handsome, I lay most stress upon a good shape, sensible, a little learning will do, well-bred, chaste, and tender. I am an enthusiast in my notions of fidelity and fondness. But as to fortune, the larger a stock of that, the better, as money is an essential ingredient to happiness in this world.
Well, then,
Even sinners needed money, didn't they? And hadn't he found just what he wanted in me? I met his cold list of qualifications precisely. It hollowed out my heart to know it. Made of my soul a barren land.
Surrounded by the detritus of my husband's life, I didn't think there were any new ways in which his letters could hurt me.
But then they did. "Next fall completes my doom," Hamilton wrote to Lawrence before our wedding. "I give up my liberty to Miss Schuyler. She is a good-hearted girl who I am sure will never play the termagant. Though not a genius, she has good sense enough to be agreeable, and though not a beauty, she has fine black eyes."
A good-hearted girl, not a genius, not a beauty. Not enough.
He wrote these things to John Lawrence while whispering against my lips that I had bewitched him. While writing me sonnets, while buying me wedding gifts with John Lawrence's money. "In spite of Schuyler's black eyes, I still have a part for the public and another for you. So your impatience to have me married is misplaced. A strange cure, by the way, as if after matrimony I was to be less devoted than I am now."
The page slipped from my hand. Our courtship had been merely another scheme. Lies, lies, schemes, and lies. When we danced together at that first winter's ball in Morristown, I'd been wary of Hamilton because he reminded me of the watery nicks of Dutch legend, luring maidens to dangerous depths. And now, at long last, I was drowning. Wrenching my wedding ring off my finger, I threw it into the trunk with the rest of Alexander's deceit, thinking to send all of it to the bottom of the river. Because, my God, this was to lose him again. A second kind of widowhood, one that obliterated the first. For I could have no hope of meeting with Alexander in heaven now. He was more likely to be found in hell. And I hoped he burned there. For he never loved me. He was never mine. He made vows before an altar and played the part to the last. But Alexander Hamilton was as false a villain as his enemies claimed he was. He had cheated me of my whole life and got away with it. Cheated. That was how I felt, surveying all that remained of my husband's legacy. What was his legacy? Not the eternal bonds of love, not the earthly but enduring stone of monuments. Only paper. A worthless constitution that the Republicans shredded with each successive administration. A few books filled with words he probably never meant in earnest. Just crates and crates of paper. And I wanted to set fire to it all. I awakened to the whisper of papers falling like dead leaves upon a forest floor. And as I blinked against the bleary haze of shadow and cracks of sunlight, I couldn't fathom where I was. The attic. I'd somehow fallen asleep there in the heat, exhausted by an agony of the soul. And now I saw my son's bare feet upon the wood planks, loose pages strewn by his toes. For one absurd moment in the delirium, I thought to scold William, as I'd done when he was a child, for walking about like a barefooted street urchin instead of a young gentleman. But then I saw the lace garter clutched in his hand. William was reading my sister's letters. And I didn't think the burning flush upon his cheek was exertion or summer heat. "I came up because I worried for you, but I didn't want to wake you when I found you asleep. You haven't slept much lately." My heart jolted, and I shoved myself up. It was all I could do to resist pulling the paper and lace from his hands. But in doing so, I'd only expose myself, expose everything. He couldn't possibly attach any meaning to that garter, which had slipped off my sister's thigh long before he was born. But oh dear Lord, how much had he read? "I'm sorry to have worried you," I managed, struggling for breath in the now hellish heat of the attic. Perspiration pooled at my nape, and my black frock clung to my back. William quietly nodded.
but his expression was bleak and his eyes were a storm. My father wrote these letters to Aunt Angelica. Those were the words he spoke, but not what he truly meant to ask. And I could almost see it. Almost see William standing at the precipice of a suspicion that would shatter everything he believed about his father and about himself. And what mother, especially one clinging to that same edge by her fingertips, could allow her child to fall? Forcing a smile, I said, "Oh, yes, your father and Aunt Angelica were very good friends. It's such a comfort to me to read their letters and remember it." My son, the one born while his father confessed adultery to the world, swallowed hard. He scrutinized my face, and then his gaze fell to my hand. "You're not wearing your ring." As my mind raced, I thought I might be sick. Burr once said I wasn't an actress of any talent. It was my sister who could bury her misery and heartbreak beneath pleasantries and a fan of playing cards in her hand. But now I called upon whatever powers of deception I'd ever learned from her to say, "The heat has swollen my fingers." I kissed my boy's cheek. "Or perhaps I've been eating too much. Speaking of, shall we go down and fix some breakfast?"
"You haven't eaten anything," William said. "Not more than a nibble for days."
What a Hamilton he was. A dogged interrogator assembling proofs and challenging my testimony. But I determined then and there that he'd never find me out. "Well, that explains why I'm so famished," I said, feigning a lightness of spirit I didn't feel and might never feel again. "And thirsty. Will you fetch me a glass of switchel?" He nodded, slowly relinquishing to me the letters and his aunt's garter. And I believed he was tricked by the mask I presented. I realized later that I was wrong. But I didn't know that then. I only knew it was a mask I was determined to wear from that day forth, because I couldn't deprive my children of their cherished memories of their father. Not after I'd nursed them all on a reverence for Alexander that neared worship. I'd hoped that lionizing their father would compensate my children for the absence of his guidance, protection, and comfort. That it would somehow make up for the suffering he'd exposed them to, for the debts he'd left, and for the scandal he'd saddled us all with. Was it comedy or tragedy that after all my husband had done to defend his name, there was not a corner of the country where Hamilton did not conjure up salacious gossip of harlots and infidelity? No place the name Hamilton did not rouse animosity amongst those who held political power. My sons had, each of them, felt compelled to become soldiers to prove themselves loyal, useful, and worthy of the country they'd been bequeathed. And given those circumstances, no mother who loved her children could ever wish to infect them with the contagion of doubt that now malingered inside my breast about what kind of man their father had been. They knew him as the mythic hero who'd driven a carriage of the sun across the sky. They didn't need to know he'd crashed it into my world, leaving me in fiery ruin. So there was no one with whom I could share my bitter cup of poison. I would simply have to swallow the injustice down and lie about the taste until it killed me. Or until the shame of it burned me alive.
"I shall never forget the destructive majesty of the flames."
Harry Smith on the burning of Washington. The nation was on fire, and part of me wanted to watch it burn. To bear witness to the end, just as I'd borne witness to its beginnings. Everything to which I had devoted my life in flames. In our capital, British soldiers had put a torch to the naval yard, the Congressional Library, and burned the president's mansion right down to Dolly Madison's bright red curtains. Our president was a fugitive in his own country, having been forced to flee his supper, his wife at least prescient enough to steal away with famous portraits and national treasures before it all went up in smoke. "These blundering Republicans have led our country defenseless and naked into this lake of blood," Alex shouted, thumping one fist on the window frame while his other hand gripped the sword swaying at his hip. And I was pained by how much like his father he looked in uniform. My soldier sons had stopped at the Grange on their way to take up defense of New York Harbor, two of them seated by the open windows in the parlor, all of us sweltering in the heat. As if the flames engulfing Washington City reached us here, too, even where I sat with my embroidery upon one of the old faded chairs.
"If President Madison loses this war, we lose the country," James said,
and I bit back a bitter laugh. Hamilton had warned that the country needed a standing army and had been vilified for it, even by Madison. Now the fate of the nation was left largely to a gutted navy and militias who had, under the direction of Secretary Monroe, already run from the fight.
"So they've finally done it," I said, startling my sons with my venomous tone as I stabbed my needle into the cloth.
"The Republicans have finally wrecked it all." The federal city that Hamilton had negotiated to bring into existence was now burned to the ground. It was quite possibly the end. The end of the Republic, the end of our American experiment, the end of the United States of America. What had been the point of any of it, I wondered. The Revolution, the Federalist, the Constitution, the farewell address, the bank charters, the legal precedents. All Hamilton's accomplishments worthless and dismantled and soon to be forgotten. Perhaps I should, with diabolical glee, burn his papers to save the King of England the trouble. Except those weren't only Alexander Hamilton's accomplishments. Other people had sacrificed to see those things brought about. They were our accomplishments, too. Perhaps alarmed at the bleakness of my words, Alex folded his arms over his uniformed chest, a uniform his father had designed with my help, and said, "The war isn't over yet, Mother." "But it is for me," I thought, because as everything turned to ashes in my mouth, I was too tired to fight anymore. Tired of fighting Jefferson and Burr and Monroe, fighting the Republicans and the Federalists, fighting grief and loneliness and bitterness and the British besides. Fortunately, a new generation took up the call in defense of their country. While my old friend Mac lay paralyzed upon a sick bed from which he would never rise again, the soldiers at his Fort McHenry fended off a stunning bombardment of rockets and mortar shells in Baltimore Harbor, giving the British just enough time to reconsider whether subduing America was really worth the fight. And so, the three-year-long War of 1812 ended in a stalemate that allowed Republicans to pretend to have achieved something other than bankrupting the nation and destroying the Federalist Party. Though perhaps it could be more properly said that my husband's Federalist Party killed itself as ingloriously as its founder had. My husband had thrown away his life, whether he'd intended to or not, a question that kept me up many nights. And his party dashed itself to pieces with a failed and potentially treasonous attempt at secession in the midst of a war. "If they break this union, they will break my heart," Alexander had said upon his deathbed. But I couldn't seem to care, because when he broke our union, he'd broken my heart, too. He'd promised that he was mine forever, that he'd never leave me alone or desperate. But then he'd rowed across the Hudson River at dawn to meet an empty vessel of a man who wasn't worth his spit, let alone his life. He'd gone knowing he might never return. He'd planned it. And he'd kept it from me. How could I ever forgive him? All that mattered now was that my sons had survived the ordeal of their own honorable battles in the War of 1812. And so did the country, though I might be excused if in the 10 years that followed, I scarcely recognized the nation as my own. We were all Republicans now, like it or not. No one disagreed or dared to. Our new Virginian president, James Monroe,
a recent convert to the Hamiltonian idea that we needed a strong regular army even in peacetime, declared it the era of good feelings. He'd actually run unopposed for the presidency, for there were no more political parties and we were not to have partisanship in the nation. We were to live in a perpetual state of patriotic oneness. It was, after all, a decade of deceit. Republicans pretended there was nothing whatsoever hypocritical about their newfound embrace of a national bank and federal institutions. Never mind that they'd destroyed my family for championing those very things. A retired Thomas Jefferson was now the so-called Sage of Monticello, the prophet of democracy, while to hear people tell it, George Washington had been a mere general in the cause. And Alexander Hamilton had never existed at all. A whole generation of Americans came of age without hearing my husband's name, unless it was in diminishment or a curse. And I could scarcely blame them. Hamilton was safely dead and forgotten. We survivors of the founding of the country all let him be forgotten. Even me. Chapter 41. September, 1824, New York City.
Mama, we have a visitor,
Lisbeth whispered loudly from outside my office door at the orphanage. I peered up from the account books I kept as the society's first directress, my hand cramped around a quill after hours of recording and resolving the entries. At nearly 25, Lisbeth had declared herself a spinster, quite contentedly on the shelf, which was why she often assisted my work at the orphanage's Bank Street headquarters, where there were now beds for 200 of the city's neediest children. Lisbeth reminded me of myself when I was about her age, convinced that I, too, would be a spinster. But more than me, she still resembled a more subtle Angelica, except for her unadorned hair and the spectacles she wore upon her nose whenever it was buried in a book, which was often. Lisbeth was a serious and sensible young woman, without girlish caprice, so I couldn't fathom her excitement as she hovered in the doorway, positively vibrating with giddiness. "What visitor?" I asked, not remembering any appointments. "See for yourself," Lisbeth said, stepping aside to reveal two distinguished-looking gentlemen. One, a middle-aged Frenchman, the other, the last living general of the Revolutionary War. I rushed to my feet, and the familiar sight of him filled my eyes with tears. Though I'd never seen the Marquis de Lafayette out of uniform before, he was instantly recognizable to me as a hero of a bygone age, and as my friend. Stouter than I remembered, and bent with age and whatever torments he'd suffered all those years he was held in a dungeon during the French Revolution, but still the slope of that forehead and that patrician nose were unmistakable.
"Madame Hamilton,"
Lafayette said, making a formal bow with cane and top hat in hand.
"General Lafayette,"
I whispered, rounding the desk. And that's when I realized the taller man at his side was his son.
"George?"
George smiled and stepped forward swiftly to kiss my cheeks.
"Oh, it fills my heart to see you again. I've never forgotten what you did for me all those years ago when I was in hiding."
He ducked his chin, as if he couldn't say more without being unmanned. On instinct, my hands went to his cheeks as if he were still a boy. But in truth, his hair was shot through with silver, and I couldn't help but think that my Philip would have been about his age now if he'd lived. Perhaps Lafayette was thinking this too, because the general spoke to me in consolation for my losses, and I returned mine for his. And finally remembering the rest of my manners, I presented my Lisbeth, who tittered like such a flibbertigibbet, one might think she'd never met a general before. But of course, Lafayette was no mere general.
The entire country was poised to give him a hero's welcome, with toasts and spectacles in honor of the forthcoming 50th anniversary of the revolution. It was said that in all America there wasn't a heart that didn't beat with joy and gratitude at the sound of Lafayette's name. My heart certainly did. Already the city of New York had greeted him with booming cannons to a conquering hero, which was quite possibly why Lisbeth nearly swooned when Lafayette kissed her hand. "Mademoiselle Hamilton," he said to my daughter, his world-weary, haggard eyes crinkling at the corners with his smile, "you must not be shy. Your father was more than friend to me. He was a brother. We were both very young when our friendship formed in days of peril and glory, but it suffered no diminution from time. So you must think of yourself as family to me." The enormity of this statement, if only for what it meant to Lisbeth, melted my heart. "And you, madame," he said, turning to me, "you are my sister, and were before you ever met your husband, oui?" It was a touching sentiment, one that recalled to me long-ago days in Albany. And though I had brothers of my own, by blood and marriage, I couldn't help but return it. I remember and feel the same. So it shamed me when he nodded and said, "I worried for your health when I did not see you at the welcoming parade. Georges told me no esteemed woman of sense would jostle with a New York crowd in this heat. Mon Dieu, this heat!" Lafayette dabbed at the sweat on his forehead. "But I could not be satisfied of your well-being until I set eyes upon you myself. As I wished to learn more about your charity work, I tracked you down here." I flushed at the shabby state of my crowded little office, with its decades-old desk and sagging bookshelves, but even more so because I hadn't been invited to the official celebrations by the Republicans, who now held power in government. Given how shamelessly they claimed the mantle of patriotism all for themselves, my presence would have been an inconvenient reminder to everyone of my husband. Or perhaps they'd simply forgotten me as they'd forgotten him. But Lafayette hadn't forgotten, and I feared I'd given offense. But before I could offer words that might make up for my absence, Lafayette shook his head. "I hope you do not think to apologize, especially since I wish to impose upon you for something," he said, a sly twinkle in his eye. "By all means," I said, gesturing at the chair. "Shall we sit?" I was pained to see him leaning so heavily on his cane as he lowered himself into the rickety seat. "Lisbeth, perhaps our guests would enjoy some lemonade?" The men exclaimed their thanks, stirring my daughter from where she still stood, riveted at the door. "Oh, right away."
"I'll help you," Georges said, like the good, dutiful boy he'd always been.
"What can I do for you?" I asked Lafayette, aware of the flurry of people suddenly finding reason to pass my office door. The matron of the orphanage, checking the lock on the kitchen larder, our cook, grabbing a broom from the hall closet, a little girl, not at school because she was sick, peeking down from the stairs. Lafayette winked at the child, and she scampered away with a delighted giggle.
"I am called to America by President Monroe to witness the immense improvements and the prosperity of these happy United States, so I can report back to the world that they reflect the light of a far superior political civilization."
Though almost everyone who met Monroe in his younger days had dismissed him for a lackwit, I'd been right about him in at least one respect. There was always, always more to James Monroe than met the eye. And he'd proven, as president, to be more of a master of national propaganda than any of his predecessors. He'd somehow persuaded the nation that the War of 1812 had been a glorious victory instead of a humiliating stalemate. And now, to drum up support for his new doctrine of superiority in the hemisphere, he presented himself as the last founder of our country.
If he could somehow wrap himself in Lafayette's glory and portray southern slave owners as virtuous guardians of liberty, so much the better. But our French hero still maintained an independent mind.
I wish to see more than what is on my official itinerary here in New York. I should like you to reveal to me the true United States. What must I see?
Me? I was most assuredly not part of Monroe's plans for this visit, the realization of which made me instantly intrigued.
Indeed, for while I feel an inexpressible delight in the progress of everything that is noble-minded, honorable, and useful throughout the United States, I will not look away from the flaws. And in particular, the status of the Negro raises a sigh or a blush according to the company. The measure of a country is, for me, not to be found in prosperity, but in a virtuous resistance to oppression. Even as President Monroe's guest, I will not miss an occasion to raise the question of slavery and defend the rights of all men, which is why I presume upon you.
My heart beat in sudden excitement that there remained amongst us a patriot willing to stand against Virginian hypocrisy. I will do whatever is in my power, if you should name it.
Lafayette smiled. I wish to know more about your work here and at the Free School for Young Africans that your husband and the Manumission Society founded for poor children of former slaves. In fact, I would like to tour both with you as my guide.
My work. During the War of 1812, I'd been too tired to fight for the country anymore. I'd decided that I'd fight only for my children, and for the hundreds of orphans who depended on me. For whatever I had or had not been to Alexander Hamilton, my Maker had pointed out a duty to me and given me the ability and inclination to perform it. My husband had a gift for government, but I had a gift for charity, a talent for it, if there be such a thing. I'd already helped to found a society to care for widows, an orphanage to shelter children, and a school to provide guidance and learning. There was not an aspect of the management for any of these endeavors with which I was not intimately acquainted. I laid cornerstones, raised money, rented property, made visits to the needy, nursed the sick, procured coal, food, shoes, and Bibles. I kept account books, wrote charters, and lobbied legislatures. How gratifying that Lafayette should appreciate all that and treat me as a person of moral consequence. A warmth stole through me at the flattering notion that he felt I could guide him in seeing the true America. But for the recognition of my calling, I felt more honored than I could ever remember being. More energized, too, as if remembering myself after a long slumber.
Marquis, may I present to you our instructors and students? I said, introducing him to the gathered ladies and rows of smiling public school children at the African Free School, all wearing Lafayette badges made of satin ribbon, each straining to catch a glimpse of the great man. Our tour of the orphanage had been short, but had allowed me to send someone ahead to prepare the school administrators for this little assembly.
And that someone was Mrs. Fanny Anthill Tappan, my adoptive daughter, now returned to New York all grown and happy with a husband and children of her own.
For years now, it had been a balm to have Fanny in my busy life again, and her eagerness to assist in my charitable work filled me with pride. Bracing upon his cane, Lafayette kissed both of Fanny's cheeks in the French style. Then he walked the length of the gathering, greeting every child.
"What a bright, industrious group of pupils," he said.
The original free school for Africans was only one room, and could admit only 40 students, I explained, as we toured the new buildings, in which were educated more than 700 of the best and brightest. The English headmaster finds these black children every bit as capable as white children. Lafayette didn't seem surprised.
I regret that my own efforts to emancipate slaves in the French colonies was forestalled.
He trailed off there, his mind seeming to retreat to a dark place, and I worried it was the darkness of his old prison cell. To draw him back, I said, "There's still more to be done, but our state legislature passed a law of gradual emancipation, and complete abolition is nearly accomplished. It cannot happen soon enough." Though I'd long been a convert to the cause of abolition, I hadn't spoken before in public against the national cancer, and Lafayette's presence encouraged me. No longer needing to measure my words for fear of how they might affect my husband's political career, I felt a freedom to say exactly how disillusioned I was. In the South, the vile institution of slavery spreads like a contagion. Such is inevitable when the country has been run these past 20 years by presidents and congresses elected by the counting of slaves as 3/5 of a person for the purpose of representation, while not otherwise counting them as a person at all. The South doubly reaps the benefits of slavery at the expense of fairness, morality, and liberty. Lafayette turned an appraising smile on me.
You're something of the passion of Hamilton in your speech, madame?
Heat infused my cheeks as I struggled with the complicated emotions dredged up by the comparison, but fortunately, a gaggle of awed children swarmed the general, distracting him from my reaction to words which were, at once, the highest praise and a painful reminder. Finally, Lafayette escorted me outside and turned to me with fondness.
You do good work here, Elizabeth. You will perhaps finish what we started.
I tilted my head. What we started?
The revolution. It is unfinished. Maybe liberty must always be fought for. And you have kept fighting when others laid down their swords in defeat, or exhaustion, or corruption?
I'm afraid you misjudge me, I said, feeling an ache of shame in my breast. I stopped fighting long ago. Lafayette gestured at the school behind us.
Then what is this school? What is your orphanage? These things seek to expand the promise of America, to give opportunity to all as free citizens.
Tears pricked at the corners of my eyes as my ache of shame melted into recognition. I'd not thought of my work as more than charity, but it always had been. Whatever I told myself, I never stopped trying to finish what we started when we were all so young and idealistic about what this nation could be.
Would that my friend was here to help you? Lafayette sighed. Will you take me to see him? I wish with your blessing to lay a wreath upon Hamilton's grave. But there is no ceremony planned for it.
Of course no ceremony had been planned. For years now, even I had shied away from the monument in Trinity Churchyard where my husband was buried. I made any number of excuses for my reticence. The distressing reminder of my losses. The spectacle of people looking at me when I knelt beside the stone. The fact that I'd suffered for a public life and didn't wish my most private grief to be exposed. All these things were true, of course. But the real reason I didn't go was because both Angelica and Alexander were buried there. For 10 years, I'd hid the festering wounds of my suspicions from everyone, in every way I could. My greatest failing in that endeavor had been with William, who was, I'd learned, never fooled by my facade. He'd seen his father's letters to my sister, and worse, he'd seen me laid low. It had changed something in him to have the heroic image of his father shattered. And we'd lost him over it. He'd withdrawn from West Point and gone west, as far as he could go from civilization, all because I couldn't leave a matter alone. So I didn't intend to reopen it now.
You have my blessing to go to the grave, of course, General. But I've already taken too much of your time. Your public is waiting.
Let them wait, Lafayette said, offering me his arm. Hamilton is more important.
Having no way to refuse him without exposing myself,
I took his arm. But anxiety seized me as we made the short carriage ride to Trinity Churchyard.
For your itinerary, I said, hoping to distract myself from the clawing dread. There are other benevolent societies you might visit, almshouses and the great hospital, too.
You might take in the Trumbull painting at the Academy of Arts, and I've no doubt the Society of the Cincinnati would host you for—
Dear sister, is it so strange that I wish to visit graves?
Oh, no, of course not,
I said, swallowing down the nerves that had me rambling. Lafayette's shrewd gaze told me he sensed something amiss, and I was relieved he didn't press the point.
As a young man, I would have thought so. But then I did not expect to live this long.
Considering the way you've habitually thrown yourself into danger for the cause of liberty, it is rather a miracle that you're still alive.
You are not the first person to say so.
He chuckled, but then his smile faded.
Is it too painful for you to visit Hamilton's graveside?
No.
I folded my gloved hands in my lap. Then, unable to withstand his scrutiny, I finally admitted,
Yes, it is painful,
but a duty too long neglected.
I understand, Lafayette said with a sympathetic nod.
He couldn't possibly understand, but I smiled politely.
After all these years, I go too little to visit where my Adrienne sleeps her final sleep.
I realized almost with a start that he'd been a widower nearly as long as I'd been a widow.
Is your wife buried far from where you now reside?
Lafayette nodded, his eyes going to the window.
She wanted to be buried with her family. A mass grave in Paris where, after being guillotined for the misfortune of noble blood and a relation to me, the bodies of her loved ones were dumped. It is sometimes too difficult for me to go where I must bear the weight of it upon my shoulders. Instead, I made a shrine of Adrienne's room, still as she left it, and where it seems I am less separated from her than anywhere else.
This sentiment was familiar to me, having myself sought in vain for the essence of Alexander in this world. And I was moved by the raw pain in his voice for a loss experienced nearly 20 years before. Unfortunately, his embarrassment at having betrayed that pain was obvious, and he pleaded,
S'il vous plaît, pardonnez-moi. It is only that I wished many times to show my wife this country, and now here I am without her. Welcomed in a manner that exceeds the power to express what I feel. Thus I cannot resist an opportunity to confide my anguish to a friend who can understand.
I could understand.
I once pored over my husband's letters every night, trying to recall the inflections of his voice, and every morning gazed upon his portraits and bust, trying to remember the lines of his face.
General, you must never ask forgiveness for confiding in me. I know this same unhappiness well.
He let out a breath of relief.
It was worse in the beginning. Having married so young, I was so much accustomed to all that she was to me that I did not distinguish her from my own existence. I knew that I loved her and needed her, but it was only in losing her that I finally see the wreck of me that remains. Now I am not unsatisfied with my excellent children of friends, but I recognize the impossibility of lifting the weight of this pain, this irreparable loss.
Yes,
I whispered, because emotion rose like a knot in my throat as he eloquently echoed my own feelings. My whole life had been fused with my sister and my husband, and having lost them both to death and betrayal, I also lost myself. I put my hand upon Lafayette's and whispered,
You must believe that your loving wife wouldn't wish you to carry this weight.
Though Lafayette didn't look at me, the corner of his lips hinted at a smile.
No, she would not. My sweet companion was a forgiving woman and an angel who, for 34 years, blessed my life.
It was the word angel, spoken so reverently, that triggered a memory of Alexander whispering it against my hair, my ear, my neck. And my mind threw up a now familiar defense against these memories whenever they assaulted me.
It was all a lie. You never knew him. You never knew him at all.
Perhaps that was why I murmured with something akin to envy,
"You may at least take consolation that after so many years of happy marriage, you achieved perfect knowledge of one another."
At this, Lafayette roared with sudden laughter.
"Perfect knowledge, mon Dieu! My wife kept secrets to the very end. Do not ask me to reveal them, but they confound me to this day. Just like a woman."
I blinked, thinking that it wasn't only women who could keep confounding secrets. And it occurred to me like a bolt from the blue that I was sitting next to the only man alive who might know the answers to any of the questions that burned through the fabric of my very soul.
Lafayette would understand.
That's what Alexander had said to me upon the death of John Lawrence. The only words he would say, in fact. The thought that the general might have been aware of the true nature of my husband's relationship with Lawrence made heat sear its way from the tips of my ears to my toes, leaving me in unbearable mortification.
"Are you unwell, madame?"
For a moment, I couldn't answer, for fear of what I might say, what I might ask, what accusations I might make.
"None of it matters,"
I told myself. There was no longer any possible reason to care. The opposite of love, I thought, was not hatred, but indifference. And for my own survival, I'd made my heart indifferent to Alexander Hamilton. There was nothing but humiliation to be gained by asking questions. Nothing to be gained by caring at all.
"It's only the heat,"
I said by way of excuse, schooling my features into politeness as the soaring steeple of Trinity Church came into view. Alexander Hamilton, the patriot of incorruptible integrity, the soldier of approved valor, the statesman of consummate wisdom whose talents and virtues will be admired by grateful posterity long after this marble will have moldered into dust. The last line inscribed on the headstone had been comforting when we buried Alexander here, but I no longer believed it. Lafayette, however, was deeply affected. With a quivering lower lip, the old general gently rested his gnarled hand atop the white stone and spoke to my dead husband.
"At last, here I am. It is Lafayette, your old and constant friend. It is my hope that wherever you are now, you will remind me to our brother soldiers who have not forgotten their long absent comrade, and to my ancient friends all gathered about you."
As it happened, it didn't matter how firmly I had resolved to feel nothing. It simply wasn't possible to stand at my husband's grave and give dry-eyed witness to this sad reunion. My own lip quivered when Lafayette placed the wreath against the stone and bowed his head in silent and tearful communion. He passed a long time like that, quiet and stooped, and I found that my heart was not made of stone after all, for Lafayette's emotion stirred something in me that I simply couldn't contain. And when he raised up again, he noticed.
"You will want a moment alone with him?"
"No, it's..."
"I will wait by the gate," Lafayette said, withdrawing. "I understand."
He didn't. He couldn't. Because I didn't understand it myself. Now left alone at my husband's graveside, I hugged myself tightly, trying to make sense of it. Aware that for the first time in a very long time, no one was watching me. The way the graveyard was situated, people passed gaily on the street just beyond the iron rail, laughing and going about their business, without any sense of respect for the gravity of the place. And maybe I shouldn't respect it either.
"Integrity,"
I scoffed at the engraving. Was there integrity in deceiving me, Alexander? Because I didn't sense any part of him still in this world, it seemed silly to continue. But then it had been so many years since I'd spoken to my husband that I couldn't resist imagining what he would hear. Valor, I admit you had in stupid quantity. But wisdom? I spent our whole marriage keeping you from foolhardiness. And if you'd told me... I blinked back a rush of bitter tears. If you'd told me what you meant to do that morning at Weehawken, I would have stopped you. You'd be alive, and I more the fool, but... My eyes fell upon the spot where our sweet, innocent Philip was buried in the earth, and I brought my fist to my mouth to stifle my words. For I'd protected the rest of my children from this anger I felt for their father. And now, absurdly, I worried about speaking these truths in front of Philip. I knelt at my son's grave and pressed my hand to the cool grass. "You're with him, aren't you?" I whispered, realizing that if Philip was united with the Lord, then none of this would be any secret to him. Even so, I couldn't bring myself to utter the venom at the tip of my tongue, especially not the two words that would have hurt Alexander the most. "You bastard." That's what I wanted to say. What you did to us, what you did to your children, what you did to yourself. For a moment, I felt as if I hated Hamilton as much as I'd ever loved him. That's when I began to laugh. A sputtering hiccup of a laugh. Because no one, nowhere, had ever been able to make themselves indifferent to Alexander Hamilton. My husband was loved and hated, but never a subject of dispassion. Not even in death. And certainly I could never be indifferent to him, no matter how I'd deceived myself to the contrary. I'd never know if he went to Weehawken with the hope of losing his life, if he'd betted my sister, or 1,000 harlots for that matter, instead of just the Reynolds woman. These were mysteries for which I'd never have answers. And yet, coming here after all this time put me in a near state of self-destructive madness to know the truth. It must have been madness. For I've no other explanation for the way I rose up again, suddenly, and charged after Lafayette. On the path by my sister's tomb, the old general turned, his eyes widening as I marched toward him with purpose and fury. "Did they laugh at me?" Stopping amidst stone angels and sepulchres, Lafayette tilted his head in confusion.
"Madame?"
"Lawrence and Hamilton," I said, firing the names like bullets. "Did they laugh as Alexander drew up his list of qualifications for a wife? And then celebrate how easily simple, stupid, saintly Betsy Schuyler was wooed and won for her father's fortune?" Lafayette seemed as startled by the question as I was to have allowed it past my lips.
"The sun has addled your senses, madame. Let me get you from the heat."
But when he reached for me, I retreated. "I am not addled. Only insulted by the man I married."
"Insulted?"
Lafayette softened his voice, as if gentling an unruly horse.
"My memory for those years is very keen. I can say with conviction that never in my presence did any man disparage you, nor would I have allowed it then or now." "My dear lady, only a derangement of grief could lead you to think the husband who loved
John Lawrence," I said, thinking that perhaps I was deranged. For no woman of sound mind would admit this. Alexander loved John Lawrence. "There," I said it. And now it hovered between us like a cannonball just before impact. I didn't know whether to be horrified or gratified to see a flicker of recognition in Lafayette's eyes. I thought he'd pretend at ignorance or deny it, but instead he shrugged.
"I think so. But what of it?"
"What of it?" I was, after all, not speaking of mere fraternity between brother soldiers. And yet I believed that Lafayette knew that perfectly well when he said,
"C'est la guerre. That is war."
Only a Frenchman would dismiss it with the permissiveness of a libertine.
But this Frenchman defied kings and emperors in the pursuit of principle. He was known throughout the world as a deeply honorable man, and his words carried a tone that said such a relationship was less shameful than to question it, which shocked me into silence.
"Madame," he said more gently, "you are the mother of Hamilton's children, his wife and his beloved.